Greetings and welcome to another episode of Soundography, a crash course in music, one band at a time. I'm Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And today we're talking about Jeff Lynne. No, Jeff Lynne, you know, not just solo Jeff Lynne stuff, but more importantly, the band that he put on the map, the Electric Light Orchestra. And you know, this is funny, we do this a lot, but this is not the Electric Light Orchestra, like I just said. It is just plain Electric Light Orchestra.
It is just ELO. Right. But it's funny, for years and years, I thought it was initials, like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Well, it is initials. Oh, you thought it was like somebody's name initials.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because ELO and ELP are pretty, I mean, it's just a knock down the alphabet.
It is, yeah. They come, if you look in the Rock and Roll Dictionary, one's right after the other.
And they're both kind of keyboard focused.
Edward L. Offenhans and his orchestral music. No, this is a good one. I'm really excited about this because this is a band that I've loved for years, like probably since the 70s. And for a 70s band, you never felt like ELO ever became a punchline.
Right? No, like, they really didn't. That's the nice thing about them is I felt like even like early Rush feels a little punchline-y.
Yeah. Yeah.
These guys, I feel like, other than some of their sounds, could be played equally with anything going on today.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could look at stuff like other pop groups from the 70s, kind of in this era, like Supertramp. You have your notes, Alan Parsons. And if you're watching a sitcom today about some teenagers who are like having to live with some old fogey, they'd say, you know what I found in the closet? A Supertramp t-shirt. And it would, you know, the laugh track would play, or the studio audience would laugh. But if they said an Electric Light Orchestra t-shirt, you wouldn't get that laugh. It'd be like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah. you all of a sudden the dad would have more street cred with the kid.
That's right. Exactly. All right. Let's get to the history of the band. They were formed in Birmingham in 1970 by Jeff Lynne, Roy Wood, and Bev Bevan. The music is a mix of Beatles-esque pop, classical arrangements, and futuristic sounds and images. And the band was initially put together to satisfy Wood and Lynne's desire to build pop songs from classical overtones. Richard Tandy was the other consistent member playing keyboards. And they found early success in the UK, but lasting popularity here in the United States.
I have to admit, having brought up Supertramp, those first few albums were like Alan Parsons and Supertramp had a baby.
Kind of were, right? I mean, the Supertramp pop and the Alan Parsons prog and mindfulness of song arrangement and history. I mean, you gotta appreciate the fact that ELO, that Jeff Lynne knows his musical history and knows what made classical songs classic and what made 50s rock and roll, early rock and roll, rock and roll. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, that's the thing is when you slice it and dice it down, it's all good, solid pop music.
Right, it really is. They were billed as the English guys with big fiddles here in the U.S. In the late 60s, Roy Wood had an idea to create a rock band that used classical instruments to pick up where the Beatles left off, and they used violin, cellos, other stringed instruments, horns, woodwinds, you name it, to create a more classical sound. And then in the summer of 1970, the first ELO song, 10538, what do you say, 10538 Orchestra? 10,538.
The Overture?
The Overture was created.
I called it the 10538.
Yeah, that's, 10538. I wonder what they call it.
They might just call it Overture. Like, they might just call it Overture.
They might, yeah. It's funny. It sounds like a radio station. 10538 Overture. Playing the hits.
And here's a new one from ELO, TX1138.
Right. To help fund the album, Another Move, which was a former band of Roy Wood album, was recorded and released during the lengthy sessions for the first ELO release. Now, there's been a bunch of lineup changes over the years with ELO. Lots of people come and gone. We don't want to take up the, you know, hour 15, whatever we're here for, just listing everybody that was in.
And it got ridiculous.
A member. Yeah, exactly.
It felt like that part of the Bible that said, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, which begat so-and-so.
That's right. So if you need that history, if you have a checklist, if you're the completionist and need to know who was once a member of ELO, then check out allmusic.com. There's a great list up there.
And I can say now, before we jump into the albums, This is one of the most major key bands ever.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
These guys make ABBA seem like an emo band. They're so major key.
And what's funny about that, though, because I'm glad you bring that up. I was thinking about that, too, is that all their music had the potential of really sounding the same when you're working with 90% major keys, mm-hmm. right? You know, straight solid C major, and then dropping down to a G major, and then blah blah blah. But he does so many different things with that, and interjects minor keys at just the right time. Mm-hmm. One of my five songs picked for my song list at the end. Is a great example of that. I really had a hard time. It's amazing I did only do five instead of six, because I had such a great time listening to this and discovering stuff beyond all the stuff I knew. You know, I knew the greatest hits. I knew a couple of deep album cuts, but beyond that, it was, this may have been the first time I've listened to a majority of those first three or four albums.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one too. And as I was listening, I just kept visualizing guys in Lifesaver striped shirts, tight white bell bottoms, 70s right. bro stashes, and long feathered hair on these guys, which isn't exactly the case all the time.
No, it's more afros.
Yeah.
You know, on these guys than feathered hair.
All I kept seeing was like Farrah Fawcett hair and brawny stashes.
Sure. Brawny stashes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Very good. All right. So as we mentioned, Lynn, Wood, and Bevan were the founding members. Richard Tandy was brought in as a keyboard player, a frequent member of the group, maybe not full-time, but very consistent member of the group.
Did he go on to make those computers?
It would be funny, right? I mean, he worked on keyboards, so it would be a logical translation you could make. All right, released their first album in 1971, simply called Electric Light Orchestra. Released in 71 in the UK, 1972 in the US, as No Answer, because the record company secretary had tried to call the UK company to get the name, and since they were unable to connect, they left a note saying, No Answer. Love that.
I hope that's a real story. I really do.
I know. It'd be great if it was. I don't want that to be an urban legend. But yeah.
Do you know the other thing that was released in 71 is?
What's that?
Me.
Oh, well, there you go. And what did they call you initially in the UK?
Oops.
Very good. In 1972, Roy Wood left the band, and Jeff Lynne became the band's leader, arranging and producing every album while writing virtually all of their original material. The overture, the aforementioned 10538 overture, became a UK top 10 hit, which is amazing for a track of that kind. Debut concert took place in April of 1972, and troubles hearing the string instruments over the electric ones were heard on had on a tour through Italy. Complaints about that. There were other lineup changes after the release. And at the 1972 Reading Festival, the pickup and sound problems were finally fixed.
Which I think propelled them to where they were heading. I mean, I think the idea was always solid, but it takes some skill to mix acoustic and electric instruments so that they sound like they're sharing the same plane and they're balanced. Totally. Yeah.
And see, that's something that, you know, if you're in the studio recording, you don't have that much of an issue. And I'm guessing probably that a lot of the classical instruments were probably recorded on separate tracks.
Oh, most definitely.
Or at separate times, I should say, than the electric ones. And so it was a lot easier for them to say, all right, we'll just balance this up and we'll bring this down and and even everything out. But on tour, you're kind of saying, oh, this is a whole new dynamic we've got to figure out. And they did finally figure it out. 1973 saw the release of ELO 2. That was the thing back then, right? Is that, you know, you just named your albums Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin 2, Led Zeppelin 3. And just
Peter Gabriel did it.
Well, Peter Gabriel named his first four albums Peter Gabriel, not even numbers.
That's right. I forgot about that. He was just messing with us.
That's right. He was exactly. Hey, have you heard that new Peter Gabriel album? Peter Gabriel album? What's it called? Peter Gabriel?
Again?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I was going to steal this next line, which is they appeared on American Bandstand.
Right.
And it's sad that there really is nothing like this on TV today.
It is. You're totally right. I mean, you've got...
We've got Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, but that's two songs. And it's not... you know, you don't even get really an interview with the band when they're on there. They might appear in a sketch or something, but that's about it. And you can't really count The Voice or the oh my gosh, long-awaited return of American Idol, because those are singing competitions with musicians you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. But having, you know, bands perform, I think the whole watching kids dance to it is probably where the interest level faded.
Yeah, well, it's like the MTV's The Grind, where they didn't even have bands, they just had kids dancing.
Right, right. Well, and that's what most of American Bandstand was. I mean, it was only like once per episode that you'd actually get the band lip syncing one of their songs live. I actually got to attend two tapings of American Bandstand because my aunt worked for Dick Clark. And
we'll find out later in this episode that Dick Clark was a huge ELO fan.
I believe it. I totally believe it. And it's a bummer that one of the episodes I saw didn't have ELO on it. I was lucky enough to see Richard Simmons.
Lucky?
these days, anybody's lucky to see Richard Simmons. Sparks. That was a huge Sparks fan, so that was a big one for me. And Christopher Atkins.
Who, oh, cool.
Yeah, like the washed-up drowned rat from Blue Lagoon, who released an album.
He's the Justin, what's his name? Justin Guarini of Blue Lagoon.
I don't even know if I'd go that far. He's the he's the insert name of forgotten actor who appeared in one movie and kind of made a hit and then forgot about. All right, so ELO 2, followed by On the Third Day in 1973. They started getting a little more creative with their names. At least the word third appears in the title, so you know it's the third album. One person left the band, another person joined. We're not going to give names. The American version of On the Third Day contained the song Showdown. Popular hit.
This really sounds like a Genesis title. As soon as I saw it, I went,
On the Third Day, the Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
Yeah, they really, it does really, no, I mean, the band Genesis, the, because they did things like Nursery Crime. Yeah.
That's the Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
I know.
Okay.
Believe me, I know.
You got my reference. Okay.
I got you. I'm not blind to it, Brian.
All right.
You hit me with the sheep.
Let's see. Showdown was a hit from here. Also, Ma Bell. My Mama Bell was another single from this album. And In the Hall of the Mountain King, basically a cover of the song by Grieg, was included on this.
Which has been covered a lot. Sabotage actually does one that's called In the Halls of Madness.
Oh, really?
On their album, The Hall of the Mountain King. And they play it now with a full-on string section and orchestra and choir and stuff when they travel with Trans-Siberian.
That's cool. Erasure also did a cover of it.
They did. It was very dancey.
It was, yes. Yep. Isn't everything by Erasure just super dancey? So after On the Third Day, 1974, saw the release of El Dorado. This is their first concept album, And it's about a Walter Mitty-esque daydreamer who basically leaves the real world and visits this fantastic place, El Dorado, which in you know lore is the lost city of gold.
That means the Dorado.
The Dorado. El Dorado. Lynn stopped overdubbing, and he hired an orchestra and a choir. He also hired an arranger for the string section, something he'd been doing himself. The song Can't Get It Out of My Head, Can't Get Out of My Head, was their first U.S. Top 10 single. I guess I don't need to sing these here. This became their first gold album. There were some more lineup changes, but after this point, it kind of stabilized. The lineup kind of stabilized. They became successful in the U.S. and were on Midnight Special, the Don Kirshner late night show, and they had appeared on there more than any other band in the show's history.
Yeah, they had like 10 appearances or something crazy on that show.
Oh, that's crazy. Seems like it'd be perfect. Perfect for that. Yeah, I love this album. This is one of Classic Rock Magazine's 50 albums that built prog rock.
Well, I was going to say, when we get to the point where we're actually on doing bonus album episodes, this would be one I'd like to jump into and really dig into.
Yeah. Yeah. I like this one a lot. That's a good, that'd be really good. It's a very, you know, and obviously it's a concept album, and concept albums just by their very nature are cohesive, like one big cohesive unit. But this one felt like it was one big cohesive unit.
Yeah. This one almost felt more like a musical than a concept album.
Kind of did. Yeah. Right. Absolutely did. They followed this with Face the Music in 1975, where you saw Evil Woman and Strange Magic and the instrumental Fire on High. Which the name might not sound familiar, but you've definitely heard it's the theme music for CBS Sports Spectacular that they used in the mid-70s.
Yeah, not the Agony of Defeat. That's ABC, so don't get confused.
Da-da-da-da! Not that one. They embarked on a 76-day, 68-show tour of the U.S. in 1976.
I don't care who you are. That's nuts.
That is nuts. 68 shows over... just under, you know, 3 months, considerably under 3 months, like 2.5 months. That's crazy. That's, you know, basically that's doing the math. You've got 8 days in that 2.5 months where you're not doing a show.
And you're probably traveling those days.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're going to be traveling.
Oh, you'll be traveling all the time. But when you think about it, it's 8 straight days of traveling on top of shows.
Right. So, I mean, you know, a couple of those days are traveling across like
Kansas,
the Great Midwest. Exactly. Kansas.
That's Nebraska. 2 days of travel right there.
Totally. Oh, can't imagine. But good on them. That was Face the Music. New World Record followed in 1976. Their first UK top 10 album. It contained the song Livin' Thing, as well as Telephone Line, Rockaria, and Do-Ya. Do-Ya was originally on that Move album that they used to fund the first ELO album.
And it wasn't until this listing that I realized that ELO had done this song.
Oh, really?
It had been one of
the, it was just
I have no song? Idea. I have no idea who I thought did it, but I didn't know it was ELO.
That's crazy, because it's not like it doesn't sound ELO.
No, and I know. That's the thing. I had no idea who it was. It's just been one of those songs that's always existed in, the 70s made that album, or that song. Wow. The 70s made that song. And I didn't put two and two together to get ELO until this listen.
That's crazy. Well, I love that. That's so awesome.
Yeah. You have songs like that, don't you? Where they exist in your brain and you're not sure who did it, but you know they exist.
There's definitely some 70s stuff, like for a while, Roundabout. I didn't know who did that. Just because it felt like the 70s did that song.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
It didn't feel like any specific band did it. Maybe that's how this was for you.
Yeah,
right?
It's one of those things. It's kind of like a lot of the Bay City Roller stuff. When we were listening to them, yeah. I'm like, oh, that's them. I thought this was just the 70s pooped this album out, or the song right. out.
Oh yeah, I bet everybody's got one of those. That's hilarious. All right, at this time, Casey Kasem called them the world's first touring rock and roll chamber group. The late, great Casey Kasem.
And we actually have more quotes from him upcoming, which is why I made the statement about I think you really, really like these guys.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. Well, wait, Dick Clark or Casey Kasem?
Oh, Casey Kasem. I'm sorry. Okay.
You said Dick Clark.
I'm sorry. No, Casey Kasem loved these guys.
I can see how you get the two of them confused, though, because they're kind of, you know, they did kind of the same thing.
And they just... There's a similar look, too.
There's a similar look, and, you know, it's the Ryan Seacrest kind of taking that new role as this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the sort of thing.
Sorry, that's my fault. It's Casey Kasem, not Dick Clark.
No worries at all. They followed that up with the 1977's Out of the Blue. This is a double LP, contained hits like Turn to Stone, Sweet Talkin' Woman, the great Mr. Blue Sky. If you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy 2, it's probably one of my favorite points in the film, and Wild West Hero. Each of these songs were hits in the UK. They went on a massive tour after that with a massive spaceship set with fog and lasers, the whole thing. And it was the largest grossing tour in history to that point in 1978.
And now U2 actually holds that record as the highest grossing tour of all time now.
I believe that. Gosh, which tour was it?
I think it was their most recent. I think it was actually their most recent one.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny how U2, for their roots being such a protesty, you know, wearing their hearts on their sleeve kind of group. It was funny to see them move into this phase where it's like elaborate stage production and all that stuff.
They're just giving jobs to all those poor people who don't have work.
That's right. All those union workers who need to install stage sets run light bulbs. They played Wembley eight straight sold out nights, which again was another record at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Discovery, the next album, came out in 1979. It was a multi-platinum album. It reached number one in the UK album charts. Contained their overall biggest hit, "Don't Bring Me Down." This is ELO's biggest hit. Ever. It was noted for heavy disco influences.
Heavy. It's a disco album. This is more disco than Xanadu is.
It totally is. Yeah.
And about the same time as when Kiss released what they is affectionately referred to as the Kisco album with what's that song? I Was Made for Loving You.
Yeah. Oh, right. Kisco. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is a super, super disco album. And everybody at the time was doing that. Rolling Stones' Miss You, I think, came out right around this time.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's funny. It's, I don't know, it's...
I bet you Alice Cooper in 79 did not release a disco-influenced album.
Probably did not, but there are very few, 1978, 1979 artists that didn't.
Yeah.
Because it seemed like, all right, this is the kind of thing we need to be doing now to get on the... charts. Let's see. Other songs you find on the album, Shine a Little Love, their first and only number one hit, which is surprising. Although the things you've done I wouldn't criticize, I guess you had to wait. You still have gotta make your Last Train to London, Confusion, Diary of Horace the Wimp, Midnight Blue was a single in Southeast Asia. They had promo videos made for all of the songs on the album. And at the end of 1979, they were at the peak of their stardom. They inspired Randy Newman's parody tribute song, The Story of a Rock and Roll Band, from his album Born Again.
Now, do you have this song?
I don't. I've never heard of this.
Okay.
But I'd like to hear it now that I know it's a parody tribute.
Yeah. I haven't heard it either. I'm seeing if there is a way I might be able to find it before I edit this together.
Sure. Yeah, I'll have to listen to that as well. 1980, they joined forces with Olivia Newton-John and released the soundtrack to Xanadu. John Farrar co-wrote the soundtrack with Jeff Lynne. Olivia Newton-John performed it, and she was also the star of the film. The movie tanked at the box office, but the soundtrack did way better. It actually got double platinum. You had hits on there like Magic, Suddenly with Cliff Richard, I'm Alive, All Over the World, Don't Walk Away. All of them were singles. The title track was performed by Olivia Newton-John and ELO. It's their only single to top the charts over in the UK. It's funny because you listen to this album, and when it was an album, before it was CD and you just listened to the whole thing straight through, it felt like side one is Olivia Newton-John. You got the title track with the ELO. I think the Tubes have a song on side one.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
And then side two is all ELO. It's almost like they said, all right, we'll take side one. Jeff, you can have all of side two, do whatever you want with it. But it doesn't feel like you get to ELO. After you go through the first song, doesn't feel like you get to ELO until halfway through the album.
So on a personal note, have you guys film sacked this yet?
We haven't, and we need to.
Oh, it'd be perfect.
It's sackable.
It's so ripe for sacking.
It really is. And this is one of those movies that Tina remembers loving as a kid, and we watched it, you know, we found it on DVD or something and watched it. And she's like, I can't believe I enjoyed this movie. And I think for a lot of people, if they have nostalgia for the movie, it's really nostalgia for the music.
Oh yeah. Exactly.
Cause the music really holds up. Mm-hmm. The title track I think is great. It's almost like a bookend to El Dorado, really, when you think about it. Cause it's another fantastical, mystical place. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the other songs on there are still really, really good. Magic is really good. All Over the World is really good.
One of the things that stood out for me was just how the production quality held up. It doesn't sound like it was recorded in 1980. It sounds like it was recorded with all the deep, rich technology we have now, because it still really sounds full and thick.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And now it's been turned into a Broadway musical. And nominated for 4 Tonys. What's SNF?
I don't. Maybe that's supposed
Saturday
to be
Night
and.
Fever?
No, maybe that's supposed to be and I just had the wrong placement on the keyboard.
Oh, could be. Yeah, that would be right, because A and D, and then you move over. It's like, Saturday Night Fever?
Oh my gosh, when you're not paying attention and you slide over just one key, all of a sudden everything turns into awesome. Gibberish.
I love it. Again, at this time, Casey Kasem was singing their praises. He called them a 7-man supergroup, and they hit the top 40 6 more times in 1 year, from August of 1979 to August of 1980.
Okay, not saying that's an inside job because he was a fan, but it might be an inside job because he was a fan.
I don't think so, but I do think that popularity breeds popularity. Mm-hmm. So him talking about them on the, you know, the America's Top 40 syndicated radio thing probably didn't hurt at all. Like, as far
and
as
even
people,
if you know how he'd, every now and then he'd say, and here's a quick mover up the charts that hasn't made it to the top 40 yet, but and he decided to choose to play them, other people would, I mean, yeah, I think that
totally.
I'm not saying it was a purpose like conspiracy,
no,
but because he had his fandom, I'm sure it didn't hurt.
Exactly. Yeah. He'll talk about them more than he would, say, Christopher Atkins.
Yeah, exactly. Just think, if Christopher Atkins had been one of his favorites, what would we be doing today? We'd be doing Christopher Atkins soundography.
Right. Oh my God. If we did one now, it'd be the quickest thing ever. Here's our 2-minute Christopher Atkins soundography. 1981 saw the release of their second concept album, Time. This one was science fiction themed. It was about a guy who got sucked from the year 1981 into the year 2095, I think.
Just on the border of your waking mind, there lies another time, where darkness and light are one. And as you tread the halls of sanity, you feel so glad to be unable to go beyond. I have a message from another time.
That's right. And to be honest with you, this was my favorite listen of the groupings.
I totally believe that, because this does feel like it's right up your alley in regards to the prog feel of it.
Yeah, this is way, way right in my wheelhouse.
Right. Now, they took out the string section, though, for this one, and it was all synthesizers. There were some strings in the studio for some tracks, but the overall feel way more synthesizer-y, electronic-y sounding, and really, really good. It topped the UK charts for 2 weeks and was the last Electric Light Orchestra album to reach platinum status, at least until a couple of years ago when Alone in the Universe was released. This saw the release of singles Hold On Tight, which was used for the, do you remember the Coffee Achievers?
Yes. The Movers and the Shakers. We're the Coffee Generation.
That's right. Generation. Exactly. It's such a great thing.
Say long time to be gone.
Saturday Night Live in the 80s made a joke about that the Movers and the Shakers were the crack generation.
I want to say it was cocaine. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the deal. Yeah. Twilight also on this album, The Way Life's Meant to Be, Here Is the News, Ticket to the Moon. All of these songs were released as singles, and then they embarked on their last world tour.
I love the cheesy 80s voice at the beginning, the vocoder computer. I just ate that up. I listened to that thing like 3 times. I love that thing.
And it's supposed to be such a... ooh, here's a really cool futuristic sounding thing that we can do. And it's, you know.
Maybe she even was more cheesy than the Domo Arigato, Mr. Roboto voice.
Oh, yeah, for sure. At the time, by the way, the Hold On Tight music video that they released was the most expensive music video ever released, which is surprising if you watch it, because it's black and white. With a bunch of what looks like old 1920s, 1930s black and white movies playing in the foreground. And it's not, I mean, it's remade. I mean, obviously they're real, or they're newly created black and white films because they have the band members in there. But it doesn't feel like it would be an expensive video to make. It seems like it would have been more expensive if they, I don't know, if they used real footage that they had to pay licensing fees for.
Yeah.
By the way, you're right. Actually, it was the Crack Achievers.
Oh, look at you verifying the work as we go.
That's right. Well, I wanted to make sure I got the number right. The budget of the music video was £40,000, which doesn't seem like a whole hell of a lot these days.
No.
The Honda Accord even used the song for their commercials in 2007 and 2008.
It's more than made up its money.
Yeah, I think so. However much it costs to release. And then, of course, the £40,000 video. £40,000 video! Secret Messages came out in 1983. This was going to be a double album, but CBS blocked the idea because it would be too expensive during the oil crisis, which affected the cost of producing vinyl albums. Many of the songs were cut to make it a single album, but they released as they released those on Afterglow or as B-sides to singles, so you can find everything that was originally going to be part of that double album set. The album sold well, but it was hit with a string of bad news. Bevan was drumming for Black Sabbath at the time. He wanted to join them full-time. The bass player left, which left Lynn basically doing most of the bass guitar on the album himself. Also, the lack of singles hurt the album in sales and charts. Rock and Roll is King was the single release from this thing, and it did well in UK and Australia. Not as well here, although I remember hearing it on American radio. And Jeff Lynne and Tandy started working on the soundtrack to Electric Dreams with, who were the people? It was the guy from Human League, right?
Yes.
Giorgio Moroder.
Mm-hmm. And who?
He wasn't from Human League, but that's the...
Yeah,
the
I can't think of anything. I've drawn an absolute blank.
That's all right. Okay. That's all right.
This album is musically, it's all over the place. There's so many genres it touches on. It's a little schizophrenic. I think that might have hurt it. But I love the fact that it's so eclectic. But I think in 1983, album-oriented rock albums, I think that kind of eclectic nature actually hurt it.
Yes. Yeah, I think so too. And it's just the fact that it was so far out, just so out there. Let's see. Four Little Diamonds, Stranger were also released as singles, but again, not so big. The song Letter from Spain, they used as backing music for commercials for the 25th Olympics in Barcelona in 1992.
That's coincidental.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. just looking to see if there's anything
good
else.
Good for NBC for grabbing onto the low-hanging fruit.
Right, exactly. Just looking to see if there's any more information about Electric Dreams in here. There was a lot of there was a lot of secret messages actually in the album itself. There were a little bit of backing tracks.
Mm-hmm. I remember very vividly. I was very temporarily in a Christian school. And they had a whole group of classes on backtracking and the evils of rock and roll music. And this was one of the albums they held up and said, if your parents own this, you need to get rid of it.
Oh, my God. Go into your father's
record collection. Yep.
And burn this album.
Yep.
No.
Yeah. Luckily, I liked the album too much at the time to do it, so I didn't. Good. But at the time, I was like, okay. And that was actually one of the reasons why, when I came home and told my parents that, they're like, "Yeah, we need to find a different school."
Good thing. Jeez. Yeah. The record sleeve actually has dots and dashes, Morse code for ELO.
Boy, that's evil.
There's stickers. There were stickers on the back of the record jacket that listed T.D. Ryan, F.Y.J. Fennell, G.U. Ruddock, and E.V. Nab. And all of those are anagrams for the actual band members, R. Tandy, Jeff Lynne, K. Grokett, and Bev Bevan. So they had some fun with that aspect of it. And it seems like that was about the only fun that people had with that out at the time. 1986, 3 years later, they released the album Balance of Power. This is, after a string of albums that looked like ELO albums, this one looks like a Yes album or a Bad Company album.
Just it really visually. Does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was released basically because they had a contractual obligation to release one more Electric Light Orchestra album. Lynn, Bevan, and Tandy returned to the studio as a trio to record this. No classical strings at all. All synthesizers played by Tandy.
Okay, do you think that was a budgetary restraint because it was an obligation? Or do you think it was a choice by them to just say, you know what, we're not going to spend more money on this if we have to?
It's probably both, right? I mean, it's probably like, all right, we have to do this. Let's just get it. Let's just knock it out so we can go back and do the things we want to do, get back to Black Sabbath, get back to producing, which, you know, Lynn was starting to do, I think, at the time. And it probably felt that way in the album as well. There was only one single released from this album, Calling America. They did some touring and made some TV appearances to support the album and played their last ever show in July of 1986. No announcements were made for 2 years after that. And then all of a sudden, Jeff Lynne appeared in something new called The Traveling Wilburys.
Oh, and we all know how that turned out.
It turned out well, but it became the last thing you heard from a couple of the members of the band. I mean, sadly, you know, Roy Orbison we lost during the tenure. George Harrison shortly after, you know, a few years after that. He'd released a couple more things, fortunately, after the Traveling Wilburys. But it seemed like such a great project.
Well, it was called Volume 1, so I expected more.
Right. Well, there was a Volume 3.
Oh, what happened to 2?
There was no Volume 2 ever released.
Is that just them messing with us?
I think that's them messing with us. Yeah.
I hate it when people do that.
I know. And I'm trying to see. It was like a greatest hits or something.
of one album?
I think that's how it was. I wonder if that's how it was marketed or if I'm remembering incorrectly. But let's pull this up here. Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 and Traveling Wilburys Volume 3. Did they say why there was not... it wasn't the greatest hits. It was a box set where they had both albums on CD with bonus tracks and music videos, DVD, documentary, that sort of thing.
Of one album?
Of two albums. Okay. It's, you know, one and three.
Maybe the DVD is Volume 2. Let's say that just so I can sleep at night.
It's funny just because I was wondering why it doesn't say why there was no volume. Let's see. It probably says it on those their second release. The album was mischievously titled Volume 3 by George Harrison.
Those wacky cards.
Jeff Lynne said that was George's idea. He said, let's confuse the buggers. And this, you know, paired the group down to just the four: Jeff Lynne, George Harrison, Bob Dylan, and Tom Petty.
Otherwise known as the subtitle group.
That's right, the subtitle group?
Yeah, you know, because you can't understand Petty or Dylan.
Oh, and it's funny hearing the two of them. It's like, oh, yeah, I can definitely hear. Now I hear the difference between Tom Petty and Bob Dylan. Yeah. Jeff Lynne lost interest around this time in ELO and ceased its operation. Bevan started his own ELO Part 2, which later had to be called, renamed The Orchestra. Bevan, who worked out a deal with Jeff Lynne to use the name because he co-owned it, like I said, continued working on it as ELO 2. And they released the album Electric Light Orchestra Part 2 in 1990 and Moment of Truth in 1994. Bevan retired from ELO 2 and sold his share in 2000.
And we didn't cover them because they're not canon.
No.
It's kind of like...
It feels like without Jeff Lynne, it just doesn't feel like it's ELO.
Honestly. Yeah, it's kind of like that Never Say Never Again with Sean Connery in the 80s. It's not a canon Bond film, so we don't talk about it.
Exactly. That is not a true Bond film. When you count... When the 25th Bond comes out next year, a year after, whenever it's going to come out, it's 25, not including Never Say Never Again. Jeff Lynne came back to ELO in 2000 with the release of Flashback, which was a box set of 3 CDs with remastered tracks, unreleased and unfinished tracks. Really good collection, actually. It's probably going to be the one that we link to in the show notes of this album.
Yeah, it's a good one. I enjoyed actually really going through this one when I got to it.
Yeah, because it is a good mix of, oh, here's a greatest hit. Oh, here's El Dorado introduction or prologue or whatever it's called. It's really, really cool.
Yep.
In 2001, they released the album Zoom. Other than Jeff Lynne, the only other member was Tandy for one song. Ringo Starr, George Harrison were other musicians who guested on the album.
I wonder how he got them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he was working around this time doing all the production on the Beatles anthology.
Yep.
And helping with the production of Free as a Bird and... Real Love, the two quote unquote new Beatles tracks that were made from old recordings of John Lennon's that they were able to produce with the rest of the band. I actually kind of enjoyed that. I really liked that documentary. And
that was a great series. It's a great series.
It was. Really was good. When Zoom was done, he completely reformed the band, including his then girlfriend, Rosie Vella. A tour was announced. Tandy came back for a couple of things, a VH1 Storytellers episode, and a PBS concert, later titled Zoom Tour Live and released on DVD. But then they canceled the tour. And for the next few years, they reissued a lot of Electric Light Orchestra's back catalog. Some outtakes, unreleased songs were added onto the CDs. They released the song Surrender as a single, and it hit number 81 on the UK charts 30 years after it was written. The other was Latitude 88 North. And then they released some live DVDs in 2010, including shows from 1973, 74, and 76. Then they released an album called Mr. Blue Sky, the very best of ELO's Electric Light Orchestra in October of 2012. And it's not a true greatest hits album in the fact that it's new recordings of ELO's greatest hits done by Jeff Lynne. And I believe this is probably done to own the masters of these versions. A couple bands have done this. Squeeze did this with an album called Can You Spot the Difference? It was a greatest hits album, but it was them redoing their greatest hits. And I want to say it was because they can now own the masters.
Yeah. I'm not doing this because I'm being obstinate. I'm doing it because it's a related topic.
Sure.
Not long ago, Dream Theater actually did a live recording.
As soon as you warned me what you were going to do, I knew exactly what was coming.
They did a recording, a live show, and recorded their entire first album front to back at this live show. And that way, I think they could have versions of it, of them playing it live, because the original masters were not theirs. And it gets released by people on occasion in these weird limited things, and it's always mislabeled and wrong. And so I think they just went through and did it themselves that time so they could have it.
Sure. Makes sense.
Sorry.
No. That's so funny. No, you can. I love it. Absolutely love it. In 2012, Jeff Lynne released a solo album called Long Wave. This was an entire cover album, but not done under the ELO banner, just done as a Jeff Lynne album. And he actually had his first solo album released in 1990 called Armchair Theater. So maybe three solo albums from him, actually.
Yeah.
Then came back to using the ELO name 2015 with an album called Alone in the Universe, renamed it kind of to be Jeff Lynne's ELO, probably just to, prevent any confusion with ELO 2 or, you know, there all during this time, there was a continuation of ELO that even wasn't, involving.
Isn't there some tribute band Bevan? That kind of like, you know, the Australian Pink Floyd or
probably is.
There's got to be something like that out there with them.
Yeah. BBC Radio 2's DJ Chris Evans asked his listeners if they wanted ELO to perform again. And 50,000 tickets for Festival Day in 2014 sold out in 15 minutes for people to see ELO. Jeff Lynne's ELO played the 2015 Grammys and also did a medley on there of Evil Woman and Mr. Blue Sky. Alone in the Universe.
Otherwise known as Evil Blue Sky Woman.
Or Mr. Blue Evil Woman Sky. the album was released in November of 2015, the first album of new material in nearly 15 years. They played shows in 2016, and there's plans for more shows this year, 2017. Simon Price didn't feel the same way as Casey Kasem, I guess.
Actually, I think he likes them. I think what he's basically saying here is that just keep going.
Okay, he's in there. Okay, gotcha. He called them arguably the most uncool, even defiantly anti-cool of the lot. He also went on to say that the modern band with the most amount of ELO DNA, Alodna, is Daft Punk. Can't argue with that.
Yeah, I think he actually likes them. I think what he was basically saying is these guys are a bunch of dorks, music dorks, who play rock music.
Right.
and only music dorks are going to really, really get into them.
It's totally true. If you go back and watch any of the old ELO videos, you can tell Jeff Lynne is just like us, man. He's just a dork at heart with just happens to be a really talented musical dork.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
For sure.
Or hardworking.
Well, that too. Hell yeah. Oh, dude. I mean, the multi-instrumentalist ability that he has. I know he does keyboards. I know he plays bass and regular guitar. I mean, the guy is.
And he arranged strings, and I've tried arranging strings. Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. The only way I could arrange strings is if he asked me to put them in alphabetical order. That's all
well,
I could
do. Well played.
Thank you. Tell us some statistics.
All right. The original 13-year run of ELO sold 50 million records. They have 19 CRIA, 21 RIAA certified, and 38 BPI awards. So they're really quite acclaimed.
Wow.
I knew what the RIAA certifications are, but what's the CRIA?
I don't know. I was just going to look that up. I was looking up setlist.fm.
Oh, okay.
CRIAA or just CRIA?
IA.
Huh. It's a baby camel. Or a baby camelid, like a llama alpaca.
So they have 19 of those.
They have 19 baby llamas. Canadian Recording Industry Association.
Okay.
So it's
otherwise known as the Baby Camel Award.
Right. So it's basically the RIAC.
So those awards actually look like little alpacas, and they're called the Packies.
Nice. Did you win a llama?
From 72 to 86, they accumulated 20 top 20 songs on the UK Jingles chart and 15 top 20 singles on the Hot US 100.
Wow.
They hold the record for having the most Billboard Hot 100 top 40 hits of any band in chart US history without having a number one at 20.
Really? I thought they did have a number one. No.
That was a UK number one.
Oh, right. Wow. That is crazy.
Yep.
Geez, and always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Yeah, which is better than always being the pallbearer.
Right, exactly. Hey, what does Christopher Atkins have?
He's got a Blue Lagoon.
He does have a Blue Lagoon. He's got fond memories of walking around naked on an island with preteen Brooke Shields for 2 hours.
They were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2017.
Okay, wow.
Which seems really late.
It does seem late. Yeah.
I know they're still active as of this year, but come on, that still seems super late.
I wonder who showed up to that. I'm curious. Obviously Jeff Lynne, but I wonder if
I bet you Tandy and Bevan showed up.
I would assume so.
Yeah. I don't think there's hard feelings. I just think they were busy.
Yeah, I think that's right. Totally. Evil Woman, Mr. Blue Sky. Did those two for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony as well.
Well, they already had the medley arranged, so why not?
Right, exactly. Can we just do that again? Doesn't say. Oh, just Richard Tandy.
Really?
The only other legacy member of the band who regularly appears with Lynne was not on stage. Instead, Bernie Smith was at the keyboard.
Oh, okay.
So I guess everybody but this is really poorly written. Really poorly written article here. Let's see here. Oh, and that's poorly written. Bev Bevan won't attend the Rock Hall induction ceremony due to prior live commitments. I'm sorry. Whatever your prior live commitments, I think you say, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cancel that because I need to go see the...
I need to go get into a Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it was Roy Wood. It was Jeff Lynne and Roy Wood.
Okay.
Yeah, they have the induction speech on the Rolling Stone website.
Who inducted them?
Oh, yeah, you asked that.
Yeah.
Let me see. Danny Harrison. Okay. George Harrison's son.
Okay, that totally makes sense.
It's totally appropriate.
Yep.
Yep. He should be, you know, that's as close as he's going to get to getting inducted by an actual Beatle.
Yeah.
And probably somebody he's worked with more than you know, the other Beatles. Oh,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I bet you he's actually friends with that guy. So yeah, that totally makes sense.
Very cool. I'm going to have to keep this up because I want to, I'm going to do a cover of somebody's Hall of Fame speech when I give my Hall of Fame speech this summer.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I just wish I could have a guitarist come up there with me. And
you could do like a, who's that comedian that does the AC/DC parodies so well? He was on Saturday Night Live. He did Goat Boy.
Oh, it was Jim Brewer.
Jim Brewer. Yeah, you could pull a Jim Brewer during the speech.
That's really funny. Jim Brewer. Well, yeah, I was going to be doing, or I'm doing some work for Jim Brewer.
You might actually be able to swing that out.
I might. Maybe I'll get him to go up on stage. No, dude's super busy. No possible way. All right. Let's get to the next phase of the show here, which is talking about concerts. You're seeing ELO in concert, you lucky devil, you. Obviously, you know they're going to be playing stuff like Mr. Blue Sky, Evil Woman, Xanadu, Strange Magic, Do Ya. What do you think the Stairway to Heaven song is? What song is it that if they don't play, if they do three encores, bring up the house lights and don't play this song, then you feel like, oh, they just don't care about us, the fans. We're leaving.
My money is on either Roll Over Beethoven or Don't Bring Me Down.
Those are both good choices. I would have said, because of how much they seem to play it at everything else, Evil Woman, Mr. Blue Sky. I'm going to go really out there and say, the 10-5-38 overture.
Okay. Yeah.
Go way out there.
Yeah. I think you're swinging for the fences, but I think you're getting air.
I feel like that's how they would open their concert, you know, like with that. But yeah. All right, here's what we got. Oh, I'm totally wrong. Number one, you guessed it. You got it, Hammond. Roll Over Beethoven is the number one song they played. Concert Showdown, surprisingly number two.
Oh wow, that is surprising.
Mama Ma Belle, something just simply called Violin Solo. Hey,
you can't knock it. Remember Rush's most played song, Drum Solo.
Drum Solo. Can't Get It Out of My Head. Evil Woman doesn't appear until number six. Cello Solo at number seven. Strange Magic, Bluebird Is Dead, and Ocean Breakup, King of the Universe, rounding up the top 10.
Did or did we not say that Don't Bring Me Down is their greatest hit of all time?
It is, yeah.
Where is that on the list?
Let's see how far down I have to go. Mr. Blue Sky doesn't appear until number 19, by the way.
They named a retrospective that.
I know. It's crazy. 10-5-38 Orchestra is their 34th most played track. Don't Bring Me Down, just below that, number 36.
Okay.
That's surprising.
Yeah, it is surprising. Maybe it's because it's so disco-y and they didn't even like it, but it got them the most money. I mean,
it could be.
You could have your bed made out of Don't Bring Me Down money so you can play Roll Over Beethoven.
Right. Let's see here. Roll Over Beethoven. Yeah, I mean, even in 1973, 10-5-38 Orchestra is fourth. Roll Over Beethoven is first. I'm just going through the years here and looking at Showdown went way up in 1974 to be their most played song. Can't Get It Out of My Head in 1975. Let's see when we get to Don't Bring Me Down. It has to be
79.
So let's jump right up to, there's no shows in 79, jumps right to 1981. Only one concert listed for 1981. Only one concert listed for 1982. This doesn't help. Yeah.
They were too busy doing Xanadu.
I think so. Yeah, this is...
Because if you think about it, they recorded that album in 79. They must have had to jump right into Xanadu after that because it came out in 80.
Yeah, yeah. So here's something interesting. So in 2016, they did 25 concerts, and there's a set of, it looks like, 14 songs that they do did on all in all 24 or 25 concerts. And then you see like a few songs at the end that they kind of throw in there, probably that they played two or three times. And then this one they played 20 times and stuff like that. 10, 5, 38 or overture. So the biggest ones are ones you'd all expect, right? Evil Woman, Turn to Stone, Showdown, Don't Bring Me Down, Sweet Talking Woman, Telephone Line, Mr. Blue Sky, etc. And then after that, you do get stuff like 10, 5, 38 Orchestra, Overture, Can't Get It Out of My Head, Strange Magic. So they pulled that in a little bit. But that does seem like they did that 19 times out of the 25 performances in 2016. I will bet money that for those 19 shows, it was the first song they played. Or the first song they played coming back for an encore.
Actually, the way it's structured, it could be one of those songs they play when they introduce the band.
Oh, it could be. Yeah. Or something that they play at the end of the main concert before the first encore as the bandmates are leaving and stuff.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I totally see that. All right, let's get to my favorite part of the show, where we talk about specific songs and specifically our playlist. We give you guys 10 songs, sometimes 11, sometimes 12, but today 10, that you can add to your flashback greatest hits album to compile the ultimate collection of ELO's greatest songs. I'll start. First song that I'm pulling out of that list is from Out of the Blue. It's called Starlight. This is such a sweet song, and it's got that same rhythmic piano beginning that Alone Again Naturally has. You could actually do a mashup with this song and Alone Again Naturally, and it would sound really, really cool. Next one is a song that is, we talked about a minute ago. It's 40 years old now, almost 40 years old. And it didn't really get released until 30 years after it was originally written as part of a bonus track for New World Record, but it's Surrender. For whatever reason, this song feels like it's brand new. I don't know if there's new arrangement that they did in 2007 for it or 2006 for it, but I really, really dig this song, and it's such a cool, it's a bummer that it wasn't a single in 1976 because it's so good. Number three on my list, The Lights Go Down. This is from the concept album Time. When you listen to this, you can almost hear Lindsey Buckingham style arrangement. There's a lot of unusual sounds and instruments and pieces that all come together to make a really cool solid whole, which I think is a hallmark of Lindsey Buckingham's music. It's like, all right, this really weird sounding guitar, but I'm coupling it with these vocals and this cool bass line, and it all just magically works. It's so cool. Fourth one is the song El Dorado from the album El Dorado. I think there was an actual name, a full name for El Dorado, the album, like El Dorado the Musical or something like that. But the song is so cool. It's just a really lush soundscape of you feel like you're coming over the crest of a hill overlooking this big magical land. I love it. And I feel like next time I drive to Vegas. I want to play it just as I'm coming over the hill and sing the sprawling city of Vegas laying out before me.
Because it really is the modern day El Dorado.
It kind of is, right? The lost city of gold.
The painted ledges of the Avalon.
Ding, 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 ding. I kind of gold anyway. And then finally, Above the Clouds. This is from a New World Record. And this is a really cool chord progression song for a band that does a lot of majors, as we talked about. This song throws that on its head in a couple places, in places you don't expect. Like, you're listening along and all of a sudden it's like, oh, that was a chord change I wasn't expecting. That's really cool. And there's a really great cover out there by a group called The Sun Sawed in Half. And they do a great version of it too, but love the original, Above the Clouds.
My turn.
Yes, sir.
I picked Mr. Radio from No Answer. And the reason I picked this is because it's the most Beatles song since Sgt. Pepper. And it's a really good example of that mission statement about doing Beatles pop songs with classical arrangements.
Yeah.
And I do feel like, though, that the further they did ELO, the further they got away from that original mission statement, and which is fine because they kind of came up with their own voice and their own sound and developed as a band and as musicians. But this is their mission statement in a nutshell. Then I picked Knight Rider.
For sure.
I picked Knight Rider from Face the Music because it's Knight Rider. No, I thought it was a good song. The title did catch me, and I made the Michael Knight joke, but at the same time, it's a good song, and it's from Face the Music. I picked No Way Out from Secret Messages. It was hard for me to pick a song from Secret Messages because they're all good. I enjoyed all of them. And I picked this one just because it had it appealed to me as a listener the most. Right? And that's a lot of the way this ELO stuff went, was I had to find songs that just settled in nicely with me They're all relatively similar. I mean, they're all upbeat, they're all major key, they're all pretty happy. You can't frown when listening to ELO.
No, you can't. Totally can't.
And so just finding ones that are comfortable in your own kind of body rhythmic headspace was kind of the way I looked for these. And I know it sounds silly, but that's kind of how I picked them. And that's how I ended up with No Way Out. Again, another one that was hard is I could have just picked the album Time because I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah,
but I didn't. I didn't cheat. I just picked one song, which is Here's the News. But if I can throw in a caveat there, listen to Time completely from beginning to end.
Yeah. Totally need to, because it's so good.
Yeah. And then I picked Turn to Stone from Out of the Blue as my last one. And I just, again, it's one of those ones that when I was listening, it was comfortable. It was like wrapping up in a nice, happy, bright, colorful blanket of music and sound. And that's what a lot of this was for me. I, you know, things were going on and I needed happiness and ELO provided it for me. This was the right show at the right time for me right now. So
yeah, seems like it was, right? Yeah.
And I thoroughly enjoyed it and it helped me get through some stuff. So I really am very happy this worked out the way it did.
Cool. Very cool. That's a good, a good collection. And I think it's a good recommendation too. If you're feeling down, like if you're having a blue day, Mr. Blue Sky is what you need to listen to kind of turn that around.
Yeah. It's rare that we get a group of albums or an artist that, I mean, I think other than this, who have we done that's just all so perky all the time?
The Scottish Kids.
Yeah, the Bay City Rollers.
Bay City Rollers, I think, were like this. But I think that came just with the time.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember who else was
not,
like
not
that.
Not Mushroom Head, not Iron Maiden.
Not Patsy Cline.
Not Level 42.
No, I think that's it. I mean, it's, you know, what you're describing is pretty much it.
I mean, even Duran Duran has their downer moments, and Blues Traveler, as perky as they are, have their down moments.
Yeah.
Spice Girls.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're perky.
Yeah.
10 times the perky.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Let's get to telling you about who's coming up next. I think this is another one that's going to kind of be up there for us as far as positivity. The Fabulous Thunderbirds are going to be our next episode.
You like how I added that to the note so we don't have to look as hard?
I'm very glad. And it's funny because before he did that, I was about to click on the button to see who's coming up next. The Fabulous T-Birds. Wrap them up. We'll take it. And we're going to be listening to their library over the next week. Looking forward to that. And listen for us next week talking about the T-Birds. If you want to get in touch with us, email us soundographypodcast@gmail.com is the email address to use. You can follow us on Twitter @TheSoundography. And, of course, for everything else you want, and you want it all, you need to go to soundography.com where you're going to find all the good stuff. You're going to find our playlists on Spotify, linked to where you can listen to those, unless you're looking for the Garth Brooks one.
That is not my fault.
No, not your fault. And I put up the Amazon.
Yeah, I saw
link.
That.
Yeah.
That is Garth's fault.
It is Garth. Garth and your head shaped like a honey-baked ham. You can listen to the playlist there. You can find a link to buy the Greatest Hits album that we recommend on Amazon. You can also support our Patreon, and you can also leave reviews, leave comments, tell us whatever you want in the show notes for this or any other episode. Listen to previous episodes. Everything you want is right there at soundography.com. All right, that is going to do it. So on behalf of Hammond Chamberlain, this is Brandon. It's saying that just about covers it. That just about does it for us here. We'll see you next time on Soundography.
Part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
I'm just glad you didn't rage quit after this episode like you did after Garth.
I just click. That's it. I can't do it anymore.